Quarterback missions for 2 years.
Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education Innovation and Workforce Development. It's Monday, March 16th. A couple of housekeeping notes. Representative Buckley is back, but given all the other things we're doing today, we're going to carry over his bill to Wednesday. We don't expect he's going to be sick again, so we should be able to hear it on Wednesday. So that is House Bill 2670.
He's got some catching up to do.
Thank you. So we're carrying over House Bill 2670.
Good morning.
And with that, we're going to open public concurrent public hearings on Representative Greenlee's two bills, House Bill 3335 and House Bill 2561. Representative Greenlee, if you'd like to join us and bring with you whomever you'd like, Victoria will give us a summary.
Please.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 3335 requires public universities to work with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to establish general education credentials for students who complete lower division graduation credits but do not complete course credits required for a bachelor's degree, declares an emergency, is effective on passage. House Bill 2561 requires the Higher Education Coordinating Commission to evaluate best method for overseeing public universities to ensure that at least one minority applicant is interviewed when hiring head coach or athletic director. Requires HAC to report results of evaluation during 2016 regular session of Legislative Assembly. Declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Victoria and Representative Greenlee, thanks for being here. I recognize that they're very different concepts, but we know you have a lot of other things to be doing, so we want to be efficient with your time.
I really appreciate that. I think I can handle two things at the same time.
I know you can.
I'll try. Let me start with House Bill 2561, which relates to so-called Rooney Rule, which we put in force some time ago. And that rule requires the seven universities of the state of Oregon, when hiring a head athletic coach or an athletic director, to include in their pool of nominees for the job at least one minority candidate. It's an idea that came out of the National Football League. That's why it's referred to as the Rooney Rule, named after the owner of the Pittsburgh Steelers, who got the NFL to accept that rule, and he was the first owner to come face to face with it, at which point he hired a coach unexpectedly, who was a black coach, and went on to win the Super Bowl for the Steelers. Our universities have accepted it more or less well, I would say, and I'll let Mr. Sachs make some comments specifically on that, because following it very closely, but it's varied from one of the universities that in the beginning frequently asked for a waiver to hire whoever they wanted to hire, and one of the universities, Eastern Oregon, who we heard from the athletic director, who thought it was marvelous because it allowed him to fill up his pool of applicants in a way that he wasn't able to before because it was far away from normal. Oh, I got to be careful about this. But it was far away. When the university system was intact, OUS was intact, there was some oversight on the part of the Board of Higher Education to review how the universities were doing. And when we called for a hearing in this committee, OUS would show up. You have a disabled member with you.
I'm coming. I got it. I just can't not get in and out of this committee quietly.
She likes to make
an entrance and an exit. She's good at both, yes.
But with the breakup of OUS, it's not clear who's around now to oversee it. And I've been very, Sam and I haven't always agreed, I've been very insistent that we not have any kind of formal penalties involved, but it's just become the law. And therefore, even though it's the law, it's useful to have somebody making sure folks follow it, and follow it at least to the letter of the law, if not necessarily to the spirit. So we're asking the Higher Education Coordinating Council in this bill to take a look at the problem and figure out how to develop an oversight model. And that's basically all this bill does. It hands somebody this to say, take a look at it and figure out what to do with it. We think that's a reasonable thing to do.
Great. Representative Greenlee, if you have, I think I'd like to leave it to you whether you want to turn over to Mr. Sachs now, or would you like to give us your comments on the other bill?
Mr. Sachs. Okay. He'll be brief, and then we'll move it to the next bill as well.
Sounds great. Thank you, Mr. Sachs.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, my name is Sam Sachs, and thank you for letting me speak today. I came to the state capitol in 2009 with the support of Representative Greenlee and Senator Suzanne Bonamici at the time, to put forward a bill that would become law.
Mr. Sachs, I'm sorry to interrupt. You don't have to be quite so close to the microphone. It distorts, and then it'll work much better there.
I've been told that once before.
So. Thank you.
The law that would, anytime a university, a public university, has a job opening for a head coach or athletic director, that they would interview one qualified minority candidate. When I first brought the bill forward, it was only for a football coach. Head football coach. The House Education Committee saw the wisdom in adding all head coaches and athletic directors. If you look at the statistic, athletic directors are disproportionately white male. So women, and especially people of color, are not hired into these positions, even far greater than head coaches. In 2010, the Rooney Rule became state law in Oregon. It's the only state in the country that has such a law, although 8 to 10 other states have put forward similar legislation based on the model from Oregon. And I foresee that in 2016, other states will do the same. So it's an ongoing process where other states are trying to model or copy the Rooney Rule in Oregon to bring this to all colleges throughout the country. Unfortunately, the NCAA says there's nothing they can do. So fast forward to today, 5 years later. Since the Rooney Rule has been in place in Oregon, there have been some, best way to describe it, some wins, some losses, and some ties. Some wins are that Oregon hired a African-American as their head track coach. Portland State University saw Nigel Burton hired, although not under the law, but after its passage, the first black football coach in the Big Sky Conference. Some losses are that Oregon State violated the rule in hiring a softball coach. Western Oregon violated it in hiring an athletic director and a baseball coach. Both schools said they knew of the law, but they just decided to not follow it. I've been coming to this body, to the Capitol, for 2.5 years, just asking simply that someone do a review of the law and each school's compliance with the law over the last 5 years, and to find out where we're at, what have been some of the hurdles, what have been some of the successes, so other schools can share with each other, like Eastern Oregon has been fairly successful. But I think it's important that someone review the law and review the compliance with every state school in Oregon to see how they've done. If there are other violations, there is no penalty in the law. So I would also suggest that we consider a penalty of some sort if needed. I also would like to see the affirmative action waivers that each school has looked at and either done away with when it comes to the hiring of athletic director or coaches, or more closely monitored. The schools are allowed to ask for a speedy waiver from the affirmative action offices when they go to do these hires, but more times than none, it seems to be that they ask for them all the time. So that's why I'm here today. I appreciate Representative Greenlee, Suzanne Bonamici, and really the legislature's support in this bill, because it passed 29-0 in the Senate. So there are other people in this country and really in the world watching what Oregon's doing. The Premier League the English Soccer Premier League is now looking at applying the Rooney Rule. And as I've said, other states are looking at the model of Oregon. So I think that while all eyes are upon us, we should really take the lead in making sure that the schools are doing what they're asked of, and see where we're at and what needs to be fixed going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sachs. Are there questions for Representative Greenlee or Mr. Sachs? Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sachs, in the Oregon statutes and the minority requirements thing, it says that you need to interview one or more qualified minority applicants when hiring a head coach. And then there's a section there where it says, unless you're unable to find someone who's willing to interview for the position. And it says it is an affirmative defense to the claim of violation of this paragraph that in good faith they were unable to find a qualified minority applicant. Is that what you're talking about when you talk about a waiver? Is they're unable to find a qualified minority applicant?
No, the waiver is there are affirmative action statutes and laws that each school has to follow when they open a job up. So they have to do certain advertising. They have to keep it open for a certain amount of time. And so it's a more lengthy process than, say, when Oregon State hired their most recent football coach. I think they did it in a week. So what the school, Oregon State, Oregon, you know, any of the other schools, what they'll do is they'll go to their affirmative action office and they'll say, can we get a waiver to speed up the process because we don't want to have to do all these things. When talking with Oregon's affirmative action officer, she stated a couple of years ago that they actually have an ongoing agreement with the athletic department. So my understanding is they don't have to request a waiver. They can just do it when they see the need for it. And so I think my understanding, because I don't work in the affirmative action offices and I've never been an affirmative action officer, is that these waivers were supposed to be more for that emergency period or time when you have to find a coach right away. And a lot of times universities will say that we need to hire a football coach right now because we don't want to lose recruits. I played college football for 4 years. I don't necessarily agree with that. That premise that they need to do it right now. No one knows because they've never taken the time to have a search that lasted more than, a week or so.
If I may comment on that,
please.
It is true that the University of Oregon in hiring coach did follow the letter of the law, and they've been, I think, very cautious, perhaps not following the spirit, but following the letter. The feeling was they interviewed a black applicant for the head football coach who they knew had already accepted a job with the NFL. But when we talked to the Black Coaches Association early on in the process, I was very impressed. And we asked them, well, what if this was just a pro forma hiring? I mean, what if they just interviewed somebody they knew they weren't going to hire? And their answer was a very strong answer. We're all jocks. We just want a chance to play in the game. And if we get into the game, pro forma or not, we'll win enough of them to make a difference. They were very clear about that position, and I was very intrigued. And I think sometimes universities are following the letter of the law, and that's all I'm asking them to do, because eventually that'll do enough good. So I'm not sure I introduced myself when I began.
I think it'll be all right, but thank you for that. I had two questions. One, you mentioned the experience at Portland State with Coach Burton, and I think I heard you say that they hired Coach Burton, but not by following the law, and I don't think I understood that. Could you explain that, please?
Well, so the law was passed in July of 2009. It was signed in, but it did not become law until January of 2010.
Oh, I see.
So I spoke to Athletic Director Terry Chisholm at the time and said, are you going to honor the law and interview qualified minority candidates? And he said yes.
I see.
So although it had been signed in, it didn't go into effect until – so if you were just statistically, technically
– got it.
You couldn't count him as falling under the law, but I do.
Because it was just a matter of time.
And so did he. And he's testified here before.
Got it. Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you. And then you also, I just want to make sure I'm understanding the way the bill is written. You talked about a number of things that you'd like to see in the review. Those are not listed in the review, or in the bill, I should say. Are you feeling like the bill's ready to go? Did you have amendments to be more specific, or I just want to make sure I understood that too?
I'm feeling the bill is ready to go. Sam doesn't always get everything he wants. So explain the incrementalism, and I think this bill is ready to go.
Okay.
Because I think it makes an important step forward without getting into the question of what penalty, how much, how should it be done.
Got it.
So I would like Heck to take a look at this, and then they can come back to us and say, here's how it's working.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
It's definitely ready to go.
Representative Gallegos?
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm curious about, I'd love to hear from an affirmative action officer. You know, I mean, I'm just curious. I like the idea that we're trying to address an issue of opportunity within our institutions in the state and helping this institutions in our state to sort of come up to modern times, if you will. But again, why just athletics? I mean, how can we think about this with regard to the rest of the university as well? And maybe that's a broader question for the Heck to look at. But again, I think, you know, what would affirmative action officers be saying about this? Is there a way we can sort of think about this in a broader context as well?
Well, Chair, members of the committee, I agree with you 110%. I've actually taken the Rooney Rule to Portland City Council. Mm-hmm. Couple weeks ago and asked them to adopt it for the hiring of directors for city bureaus. I think it can be applied to teachers, professors as well. And I think the difference between, you know, again, I'm not an expert on affirmative action, but I think the difference is when hiring of professors, athletic directors, bureau directors, what this law says is that you will make the intentional effort to seek out, identify, and then at least interview one qualified minority candidate before doing the hiring. That doesn't always happen with affirmative action laws the way they are.
I would say that, especially 10 years as a department chair, it was just you, that I think the affirmative action laws did come into play. And I think what's happening in the athletic side is there's been, it simply has been waived because the athletic departments have lived to a certain extent outside of the university purview, as you may know. And instantly, an example of where a waiver was needed was there was a volleyball coach, a women's volleyball coach at one of the universities. They hired a new volleyball coach. The old one retired. They hired a new one. And the new one was killed very soon after in an automobile accident. And they decided that the best bet was to rehire the one who had retired and take over so the program could go forward. That would be the perfect example of when you would look for a waiver that that everybody would agree was an appropriate waiver.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony, Mr. Sachs. And,
thank you.
We'll move, I think, now to your second bill, Representative Greenleaf.
All right. This is State Representative Mitch Greenleaf, for the record. And I'm here to bring you House Bill 3335, which came out of some discussions with Richard Schwartz, who will be testifying as well. The idea is a very simple one. If a student goes to the community college and spends 2 years at the community college and then moves on to a university or doesn't move on to a university, they have the ability to earn an associate arts degree. If somebody goes to Portland State University, as did one of my relatives, spend 3 years at Portland State University, leave the university for reasons, whatever those reasons are, they come away without anything like an associate arts degree. They come away as a college dropout, a problem for our 40-40-20 plan, but much more than that, it's a problem. It's a problem for the student. This asks the Heck to look at a way to certify something similar to an AA degree. Incidentally, if a community college student leaves the community college and moves to Portland State before they met the requirements, we have a program that backtracks that and gives them the associate arts degree even after they've earned the final degrees at the university. This simply says to the Heck, and I hope maybe somebody from the Heck will be testifying along the line, that it asks the Heck to say, can we figure out something like this for a university student? A university student who spends 3 years at the university, drops out for financial or health or other reasons, this would give that student the opportunity to get a certificate that when they went to an employer, they would say, here's my certificate of X, and we have language in here that we call it, but that language could change. that here's my certificate that I earned at Portland State University, rather than saying I dropped out of Portland State University, and the question immediately becomes, well, why did you drop out? So it's a matter of equity, it seems to me, to allow university students who leave the university, and that's what this is about, leave the university before they get their degree, to allow them to apply for a certificate, essentially a certificate of lower division completion, which would have a very similar effect when they apply for a job. And basically, it's really straightforward. It asks the heck, as I talked to their executive, they will not oppose it. I don't want to speak to them, so I won't say what. But it does seem a very simple thing, something that they could work on, and I think it would make a real difference.
Thank you, Representative Bielek. And we are going to hear from Ben Cannon.
Good.
On, so
good.
I appreciate that. Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, and thank you, Representative Greenlick. For the record, my name is Richard Schwartz. That's Schwartz without a T. I am here to urge your support and recommendation for passage of House Bill 3335. I'm retired now, but I am retired from a position of executive director of AFT Oregon, and during that time I also was a member of the Post-Secondary Quality Education Commission appointed by then-Governor Kulongoski. And that's commission is the where the origins of 40-40-20 arrived and later were codified into statute. So they remain and continue to be the goals for the state of Oregon for educational attainment of its adult population. Even though that commission issued its report a number of years ago, some of those ideas still or things still churn around at most unexpected times, and ideas pop into your mind, such as this one, because the middle 40 is the one that caused the greatest amount of discussion, I think, and if I recollect correctly from the commission, what qualifies to meet that middle 40 benchmark. The associate degree is one. That's fairly easy to calculate and make a determination. Recently, I believe union apprenticeship programs were determined to be a part of that mix. And it occurred to me, as Representative Greenlick explained, that where we generally consider somebody who leaves college in terms of measuring these benchmarks to be, for lack of a better term, a failure in fulfilling the promise of the other 40%, that in fact many of those students may, and I don't have statistics, it's not been measured, many of those students may have completed what were referred to when I was in college as basic degree requirements. In other words, those units of social studies, science, math, foreign language, writing, that no matter what your major was, were required to be awarded a bachelor's degree. So, as Representative Greenlick explained, it seemed that there should be some recognition, since we're in a 40-40-20 world, that accomplishment of having successfully completed, by the way, the basic degree requirements ought to be recognized in the same way that, because they're the equivalent of somebody who would have completed the same course material or credits in community college, for example, and for that effort they can receive an associate's degree. So there's a couple things in this thought that should be made clear. It's not an effort to supplant the associate's degree, and it's not an effort to establish an associate's degree in the university system. It's merely a mechanism to allow the student who has completed those basic degree requirements successfully to request and then receive that recognition in the form of a certificate that they can then use as part of their education credentials. I want to one of the dangers in this when you come up with some ideas that suddenly you have to learn about other things that might relate to it. And I understand there's been some discussion about what does this mean, or isn't it the same as the reverse transfer. Mm-hmm. And I learned that reverse transfer is something that was piloted through a for a two-year period from that ended last September through I think about a $450,000 grant from the Lumina Foundation, which issued grants in combination with four or five other foundations to 12 different states, Oregon being one of them. The program in Oregon involved all seven universities and I think 10 of the community colleges. What that program established is that somebody who transferred credits in to the university and then decided to opt into the reverse transfer program on their own, it takes their own initiative to do that. The university will then send their credits back at the completion of a term to their community college, which in turn will evaluate whether those credits met the associate degree requirements. However, there's no policy in the state to that describes that, and all of those arrangements are made on the local level between the universities and in partnership with the various community colleges.
But that still wouldn't relate to a student who had been at
That's the correct. University. That right. But I just wanted to make sure there was no confusion that this was supplanting any existing programs. And those are not uniform either, that Portland State requires 30 credits, University of Oregon requires 24 credits transferred in. This is distinct from that, and that long explanation, I apologize for that, was just to make sure that that didn't get confused and that this is just another side of the same card. So this is an effort as well to, I think, would go to fulfilling that the goal of the middle 40 attainment is an unrecognized element of that middle 40, and would contribute to the state meeting its goals.
Thank you, Mr. Schwartz, and thank you for the explanation too. I for one was a person initially who didn't fully appreciate the distinction. So I'm glad you made that clear again. Are there questions for Mr. Schwartz or Representative Greenlee? Let's see. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Almost Speaker.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee. So let's proceed with Meg Reeves on House Bill 2561, and then we'll come back to Ben Cannon on 3335. Ms. Reeves. So we're back on the Rooney Rule question at the moment.
Thank you, Chair Reed, members of the committee. I'm Meg Reeves. I'm the general counsel at Oregon State University. Is this okay?
Yes, that's just great. Thanks.
So I'm here. I represent OSU, but I'm here on behalf of OSU as well as the other six universities in the system. I wanted to make three points about the amendment on the table, but I might be
able
to.
The bill? I'm sorry to interrupt. Is there an amendment or the bill?
I'm sorry. The bill.
Okay, just to make sure I was understanding the same thing. Thank you.
I misspoke. Sorry. also, maybe can clarify a little bit, at least about what was said earlier about OSU's practices. So the three points that I wanted to make on behalf of the universities, the first was that we don't think additional oversight is necessary. There were definitely some early missteps when the bill was new, and one of those was OSU's, but that was not intentional. It was simply lack of awareness of the statute. And since then, we have fully integrated the requirements of the statute into our hiring processes for head coaches. The rest of the universities have done the same thing. And I'll talk a little bit more specifically about what those hiring processes look like following up on Mr. Sachs' testimony. But we also have oversight. Within hours of Mike Riley announcing that he was leaving OSU, we heard from the governor's Education Policy Advisor and from the Higher Education Coordinating Commission that to remind us essentially of the requirements of the bill. And my point here is not that we needed the reminder, but more that people in state government are really, across state government, are fully aware of these requirements and are paying attention to them and reminding us of them as well. So we don't really think that additional oversight is necessary. But if the legislature does move forward with the bill, we'd like to ask that it be clear about what kind of expertise would be appropriate to include in evaluating additional compliance measures. And we'd like to see a representative from a Division I school in Oregon and from a non-Division I school in Oregon participate, because someone with expertise in university hiring practices for head coaches would be useful, I think, in that evaluation. And then the last point really is that if the legislature is going to move forward eventually amending the statute, to consider including women as minorities under the bill. Women are not part of the definition of minorities right now. And I testified in September about this issue. We got data from the NCAA for 2013 that demonstrates that women are significantly underrepresented in the coaching ranks. The numbers at that time were that there were 5,148 head coaches nationwide. This is in Division I. Of those, 1,492 were women. So if you spread that across 340 Division I schools, the numbers come out to an average of 15.14 male head coaches and 4.4 female head coaches at each institution. So it isn't clear to us why women are not considered minorities under the bill. And if amendments will be considered, we would suggest including that consideration. Mm-hmm. And with respect to the OSU's misstep under this statute, it had to do with our hire of Laura Berg. And she was an assistant softball coach at OSU. We waived her into the position of head coach. And we did that because she's uniquely qualified. She's the most decorated softball athlete in United States history, and because her hire advanced OSU's affirmative action goals. She's a woman. At the time, I think we had 17 head coaches, and with her hire, three of them were women. So that actually is a good segue to a brief trip to how universities use waivers and how the head coaching hires are done. So at least at OSU, we use waivers to put into a position a person who's uniquely qualified for the position. And most typically, that's going to be someone who's already an employee and has been doing some aspect of the job and essentially ends up almost getting promoted into the job. And if the hire or if the movement into the position advances our affirmative action goals. So our waiver program is administered by our affirmative action office, our Office of Equity and Inclusion. When we hire head coaches, and this was certainly the case with Gary Anderson, it is an expedited process. We have an expedited process for head coaches, especially in the high-profile sports, because in the industry, that's how it happens. It's very fast, and which is not to say we don't comply with this law. We do, and we did. In the case of Gary Anderson, the athletic department interviewed two minority applicants. So, again, we don't think there's an issue here. But if you do decide to go forward with the bill, we'd like to see expertise from the universities in the mix and considering adding women as minorities.
Thank you, Ms. Reeves. Are there questions? Uh-huh. Representative Rudin.
Thank you for coming this morning. Just for clarification, when you said adding women, would you suggest that both people of color and a female, or any of the above?
Chair Reed, Representative Reardon, so the statute right now defines minorities as certain categories, African Americans, Pacific Islanders, I don't have it right in front of me, but by race and ethnicity, essentially. We would suggest adding women as a separate, women specifically to that definition. I may not be answering the right question.
It's too early Monday morning. So would there be two people, a female and a person of color, showing up for the interview, or do we just, would there just need to be one or the other?
One or the other is okay. What our proposal would be.
Representative Hayden.
Chair Reed, do the universities have a singular voice on a proposed amendment to this for clarification?
Representative Hayden, we would, we don't have an amendment now, but if the bill is going to move forward, we would like to work with the sponsors on a proposal to that effect. Yes, if this bill is going to move forward.
Call this. Wouldn't that typically take place, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, between today's hearing and a work session? So within the near future?
I think that's right. I think, forgive me for putting words in your mouth, you correct me. I'm guessing that they may be waiting to see if the committee wants to move the bill forward, and if the answer is yes, then they will engage in creating the amendment.
Thank you, Chair Reed.
Thank you.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, thank you again for your testimony. I think this bill actually provides a platform for a larger discussion. That's kind of what I was saying before as well. I mean, I'd really love to hear from affirmative action as to, you know, the notion of including women and so on is, yeah, I think an important element that I, again, as I said, I'd love to hear sort of a broader discussion. I'm also assuming you would advocate for equal pay for these women as well.
Of course. Yes, thank you.
So I had one question about the numbers you mentioned of the total coaches and the total number of women. Purely anecdotal on my part, but my observation is that there are the representation of women as head coaches varies by sport quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Do you have any information on that?
I, Chair Reed, I don't have it in front of me, but we could certainly provide it. And there is definitely some variation by sport. Absolutely. You know, I don't think there are any. Football is an obvious example. But it's not the case, for example, that all women's sports are coached by women, or maybe even the majority are coached by women. So I'm not sure exactly how it breaks out, but the NCAA is sure. So yeah. We could get that information.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm not aware of any women who are head football coaches, but I would guess that there's probably some sports where women are probably much better represented as head coaches. So how do you handle that if, in fact, there is a sport in which women are the majority of head coaches? I don't know if it's gymnastics or softball or something else. How does that, in your amendment, have you thought about how that might be handled?
Chair Reed, we haven't gotten to that level of detail, I would say.
Okay.
And that would be a lot of detail to move over into the legislative arena. I mean, breaking this down by sport.
Well, but if the point is to count women as minorities, and in a certain sport they're not a minority, I don't, it's an open question. I don't have an answer in my own mind, but
right.
I would be one to. I'd be interested in what mm-hmm. you come up with, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. I wasn't planning on commenting on this bill, but one of our members of the committee mentioned equal pay. Can we, as a legislative body representing the citizens of Oregon, taxpayers of Oregon, I've been assured that if we're talking about equal pay, that we have in rules or policy in place that will prevent what happened with the athletic director of retiring and making what he did on PERS, because that contract included TV ads and Nike ads and all that, and he should only be paid on his salary, not. Is that correct? Would you affirm that, please?
Chair Reed, Representative Wisnant, affirm that Mike Bilotti was only collecting PERS on his salary?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
If the policy is in place now that we're not going to be paying our athletic coaches retirement pay based upon Nike contracts and endorsements and TV time and all that, that was the justification that was submitted why he was making what he was for PERS, that was included in his PERS calculation, his income.
I'm sorry, I can't answer that. I don't know whether, I think that's a matter of PERS rules.
Well,
and
you
I
just
don't
commented
know
that you for equal pay, but that equal pay includes benefits. So I hope that's not the policy of the universities.
Representative Wisdom, we'll follow up on that. I think there's a distinction probably between pay and retirement. I understand your point, and we can follow up on that offline if that's okay with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, other questions, Representative Johnson?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the intent behind the bill, but I guess my difficulty with it is in offloading this responsibility to the HEC. At the point in time we were creating the HEC, I don't think we saw an overseeing of employee hiring, relationships, quotas, that sort of thing, placed upon the HEC. So under the OUS, there was a different structure, obviously, but the HEC intentionally was created to usher in a new era where each university is accountable for their own performance. And the Rooney Rule is in effect, and I believe that each university certainly understands that, and I think to the best of their abilities is doing the best they can to comply with that. So for that reason, I think, you know, I would have a hard time offloading this responsibility to the HEC because I just don't believe it fits within their purview as the institution that we created them to be. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments or questions?
Just a quick comment.
Yes, Representative Hayden.
NCAA says that women's head coaching women's team has dropped to 40% from 90% from 1972.
Yeah. Can you say that stat again? I'm not sure I understood it.
Okay, so according to the NCAA report, since the 1972, 90% of women's collegiate sports were head coached by women, and currently, and this is in Division 10.
Division 1?
It is...
I'm not aware of Division 10.
Well, Division 1. It is 40%.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying. I understand it now. Okay. Thank you, Ms. Reeves.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We are still open on House Bill 3335 as well, and I'd like to invite Mr. Cannon forward.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I'm here to speak specifically to House Bill 3335.
Thank you.
And I will be brief. First, want to recognize the intent of this bill, which I think aligns very nicely with the work and priorities of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, in particular the focus on seeing more degree and certificate pathway options that benefit students, that are understood by employers, that meet quality standards, and are useful for our students and our economy. I do want to note that there is precedent for this in the sense that Oregon universities are able to today to award an undergraduate certificate that reflects 45 credits. The Oregon Transfer Module, which is typically provided or conferred by community colleges, may also be conferred by Oregon universities to students who have completed 45 credits of lower division courses, and it does enable them to sort of package those courses and take them with them to another Oregon university where they are understood and rewarded. We appreciate the distinction that the bill's sponsors, the bill's sponsor made between this and reverse transfer. I think you've spent enough time on that issue, but can certainly help to clarify that if there are questions. And would suggest that the process that the bill proposes, where we would work with stakeholders on refining the pathways envisioned by the bill, seems appropriate. There are, I think, some important questions that would need to be asked and answered. Finally, just want to note, as much discussion as there was about seeing this bill and this possible new certificate or credential in the context of 40-40-20, which is certainly, we think, important and interesting, would share, I think, Representative Greenlich's emphasis on the potential that these certificates would and could confer benefits to the individual obtaining them, and that that's really the light in which a proposal like this ought to be viewed. Is this something that will be meaningful or could be meaningful to the student who earns one of these? And with that, I'll conclude my testimony. I handed out written testimony that contains a bit more information. Happy to answer any questions on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Cannon. Committee members, questions?
Yeah, I just want to comment on what I believe is the intent here. I mean, I'm just thinking about 40-40-20 and how even just considering this helps us to think about, you know, how we think about reaching that 40-40-20. In other words, what are different ways we can begin to look at education, the paradigms that we use in terms of what is the standards, let's say, in terms of reaching different kinds of levels. So, I just see this as another tool that we can use in doing that.
Any other questions, Committeeman, Representative?
Thank you, Vice Chair Wisnant. I think it's more of a comment, and Mr. Cannon, thank you for your comments. One of the things that you mentioned in your written testimony struck me, and it is the comment that Oregon employers should be consulted so as to make these intermediate credentials useful as a marker of proficiency in a given field or general preparedness. I think it's really imperative that we speak to the employers across the state to find out if this is actually meaningful and how they would view something like this in their hiring practices. If it doesn't have value in the workforce or in the workplace, I guess that's a question I'd like to have answered to see if it does. If it's meeting 40-40-20, that's great. I understand the value of an associate AAOT or a science transfer degree. We all know what that means. And if this has that same meaning, I think it becomes valuable. But educating our business community as to what this actually provides for them when they're making those hiring decisions, I think, is a really important key to moving this forward.
Representative McKeown, Vice Chair Wisnant, agree wholeheartedly. Would note that our earnings data indicates that, or reveals that, associate's degrees do, of course, confer a positive earning benefit on those who attain them writ large on average. Of course, they're very well known, or at least much better known than something like what's being proposed in this bill would likely be. But insofar as a certificate, as suggested by the bill, would be or could be identical or very closely identical to the content of at least some associate's degrees, one would hope that that the certificate could likewise be recognized and rewarded by employers as associate's degrees are today.
And follow up. And I think that, you know, the devil may be in the details of the semantics of what you call this, because I think in the general business community, certificate has a different meaning than degree, whether it's an associate degree or a bachelor's degree. So that education component as to how we, you know, demonstrate the value of this certificate versus an associate degree may be misinterpreted or misunderstood. So I think, you know, how we provide a definition or try and educate the community at large about this is going to be really key to making it successful should we move it forward. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Ben, I guess, I appreciate the concept in play here, too. We've obviously talked about 40-40-20 a bunch, but is this perhaps a statistic maker? In that it's a well-intentioned effort that we're grasping at straws and doing virtually anything we can to get as many numbers as we can so that we can show we're making progress at 40-40-20. That would be my fear. But also, I guess the other question would be, would this have relevance outside of the state of Oregon? Or would this be an Oregon-only type of effort to, again, create some sort of benchmark for those students that aren't able to get all the way to completion at a four-year university?
Representative Johnson, Chair Reed, I think those are good and important questions, and I'll underscore again, I think that the bill should be understood in the context of the benefit that it may confer to an individual and not the progress that it may help us make towards 40-40-20 per se. I think we ought to avoid the temptation to get to 40-40-20 through a sort of paper exercise. I will note that that both the HEC and the OEIB have endorsed an understanding of the middle 40, which we call it a broad understanding, basically a fairly widely encompassing understanding of the types of certificates and credentials, some of them 1 year, some of them 2 year, that count towards the middle 40. So I think it's very likely that that we would conclude that this type of credential would meet it. But that's not the reason, should not be the reason, I think, for doing it. And I think Representative Green made that point as well. In terms of other states, I don't know whether there are other states that have adopted in any kind of systematic way a credential that signifies the completion of lower division courses by a university student, but not the completion of BA. Nearly all, if not all, undergraduates in Oregon public universities and other BA granting institutions intend to earn a BA. We know in Oregon only about 65% of those who start do within 6 years. And so this appears to me really focused on that other 35%, some portion of whom, maybe a significant portion of whom, have completed those lower division requirements, would have earned an associate's or at least a Oregon transfer module if they had begun at a community college, may have earned the OTM at a university. And I think that's certainly a worthwhile subject for us to explore and look at.
Thank you.
Representative Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ben, why it says in your written testimony that we are not, that our four-year universities do sometimes award associate's degrees, but in limited areas and not in great numbers. Why aren't we expanding that?
Representative Williamson, Chair Reed, I think that would be a good question to ask the universities. There are very limited associate degree offerings at universities, and you know it would be sort of simple to cite sort of the historical precedent for that. But in terms of why there may not be greater interest or greater, you know, more proposals for doing so, I think you'd want to ask the universities about that.
And just a follow-up comment: it seems to me that an associate's degree as a recognized credential that crosses state lines is a better place to put our resources than creating a new credential and trying to figure out who recognizes it and whether or not it actually is beneficial to a student when, in fact, I would think many of these students could get an associate's degree instead of some sort of intermediary credential.
Representative Williams, Chair Reed, I think there's clearly a lot to explore here. And I know in other settings the question's been asked about community colleges offering bachelor's degrees or applied baccalaureates. And I think that in both cases one can sort of paint a future in which one or both of those things would occur to a much greater extent than they do today. I think that part of the reason why our system looks the way it does, with very few associate's degrees being conferred by universities and no bachelor's degrees being conferred by community colleges, is simply the desire historically on the part of the state to sort of tailor the system a little bit more precisely, right, and focus resources on the entities separately, understanding that there are different types of students with different aspirations. But given the amount of transfer that goes on today, given the reliance of our public universities on community colleges as a pipeline for bachelor's degree students, there is a pretty significant overlap in their missions and the students they serve. And so I think it's an appropriate time to be asking these types of questions.
Sure, and I understand that. I think they are two very different conversations. If a student is at a four-year university and gets to their third year and for whatever reason they can't complete, getting an associate's degree for the work that they've already done by that four-year university is a very different conversation than whether or not a community college should expand into the area of conferring bachelor's degrees. So I actually don't see those as the same conversation. This just feels like we're creating another credential for something that we may already have in our system a solution to. We're just not geared up to use that system already, or we're using it only in limited areas and with limited numbers of students. And so I actually disagree that that's a similar conversation.
Well, maybe I can pick up on your questions. I think I can see what both of you are saying. So my question is sort of how, what you can share about the development of credentials, and maybe this is too historical a question, but at some point, BAs and BSs were developed, and at some point, associate's degrees were developed. What we're talking about here is a credential that doesn't yet now exist. What can we learn from how those different credentials developed and how they are and aren't recognized in the market, in the world? Are there any lessons to be drawn from that?
Yeah, choice? I mean, I can shed a little bit of light, although there are undoubtedly others even in this room who could amplify and improve upon the answer. Degrees and the associate's and bachelor's degrees are old ones, and as a result have a kind of currency that new certificates do not. Their development and that general recognition owes in part to efforts by policymakers and, you know, if you will, regulatory entities like states. But probably as much, if not more, to the work of accrediting agencies that have established sort of standards and expectations around degrees of different types. So a university or college that wants to offer a new degree will spend much more time, frankly, consulting with their accrediting agency than they will with the state of Oregon, most likely. Because part of the desire for, national and international recognition and standards. So I guess I say that only to note that we, the state of Oregon, hold sort of some of the cards here, but the question of how a degree or a credential becomes recognized and worthwhile and transferable has a lot to do with accreditation. It has to do with sort of professional associations. It has to do with employer groups that work at a national or even international level, faculty organizations, to ensure the sort of value and validity of a particular degree or credential.
To say nothing of student demand, I suppose.
Sure.
Representative, wasn't it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative,
Mr. Swartz come back up?
Sure. It's right with me.
Sir, you mentioned the Lumina
Foundation.
You stated that it was expiring now. Is that correct?
The information that I have from the Lumina website when I tried to research this was that it was a two-year program that five foundations funded. It was Lumina Foundation, Kresge, Bill and Melinda Gates, USA Funds, and one other,
I'm impressed that you remembered four out of the five.
Yeah.
Well done.
Sorry?
I'm impressed that you remembered four out of the five right at the top of your head. Well done. Yes, please.
And it was from, it was for 2 years that expired at the end of last September.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the follow-up. Mr. Cannon, I understand some reluctance and everything, and I understand we don't want to create a new program. There's four members of this committee think this bill has some merit. And I understand in my conversation with the university people that a four-year school is actually doing an AA degree. The program that I looked up, and maybe it wasn't that one, that four-year universities in certain states are going back to the community colleges to issue the AA. They're not having the four-year school.
Yep.
And I think that has, then you don't have to get into the accreditation if those courses at the 4 year, you're reversing it. So I think this has merit, and Mr. Chair, I'd like to see us let Mr. Cannon's office and the university representative see if we can find some way to not put a big burden on accreditation of an AA degree by the 4 year schools, but really see if the community colleges can look at what other states are doing. And Oregon was part of that.
Yes.
System. So
Representative, was the way you described that, I want to make sure I understood it. Does a student who goes initially to a four-year institution, takes classes, doesn't complete, in your scenario, they're eligible potentially to get an associate's degree from an institution they did not ever attend?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Got it.
That's the way I understood the program worked.
If I may, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
Vice Chair, wasn't it? The reverse transfer is for a student who was enrolled in a community college and then moves in, but the universities in the state have varying minimum credits that are transferred, that they have to transfer in order to be eligible to opt into the reverse transfer. And it's the student's choice whether or not to send the course completion information at the end of the term back to the community college.
So then I better ask you the same question I asked Representative Wisnant. In this scenario that a student starts at the four-year institution and doesn't complete, would that sequence still work where they could send the credits from the four-year institution to the community college and seek an associate's degree?
Representative Reed, no, that is not what, at least the idea when this popped into my head and I discussed it with Representative Greenlick, is that it's somebody who enrolls in a four-year institution intending to graduate, and then for some reason, and the common reasons are health,
finances,
any variety of issues, they don't enroll and they drop out in the vernacular and don't complete a degree, but they may have completed sufficient coursework to meet the basic degree requirements.
So the key difference, it seems to me, is in your description, the credential comes from the four-year institution, not from the community college, and it is a credential that does not now exist, and the value on which is uncertain. Is that
correct.
Fair?
Yes.
Okay.
Just to try to clarify on this point once again, and you know, you can ask a community college representative to confirm what I'm about to say, but I don't believe that a community college. Let me try to put it even more clearly. I believe a community college cannot award a degree to a student who has not attended the community college. And so I don't believe it's possible for universities to sort of kick back the credits to a community college where the student has never enrolled and have that community college confer the associate's degree. I think that, in fact, is a sort of violation of the idea of accreditation and the taking responsibility for the degrees that are awarded. So reverse transfer is as Mr. Schwartz described.
Got it. Thank you. Representative Gallegos, I'm sorry we got away from
it. That's fine. Yeah, no, it's a fascinating discussion. I think that again, sort of historically, going back when I started in academia, I mean, more than 30 years ago, I mean, it was just unheard of to even think about teaching to the market. I mean, it just we didn't do that. But I think that's to me the real change in the culture of higher education. I mean, we're competing globally, we're competing nationally, and that's what I meant earlier. We need to really rethink this whole paradigm of education, and again, the outcome being our workforce development. How do we really prepare ourselves for the workforce needs in the next 20, 30 years? And I think that to me, that's what this discussion is about, is trying to help us really, you know, think about what it is we really need to be addressing in terms of preparing that workforce. And again, education seems to me to have gone from granting degrees or certificates for what you know. Rather now, we're really trying to think about what you can do. You know, and so that's the outcomes that we're having to rethink our whole educational process around. So I think that this discussion, like as I said, is very interesting and very useful. And I don't think we need to approach it from a sense of fear of what we may be doing, but rather really, again, really trying to think about the problem in new ways. So thank you for that.
Thanks, Representative. Representative Reardon?
I think I'm probably saying the same thing as Representative Gallegos is saying it, but I want to say it anyway. But I'm having a hard time seeing the value of the two-year degree that you would receive at a four-year institution. And I'm trying to think of it in terms of as an employer. If I look at the two-year degree from a community college, there's usually something associated with it, like nursing or business or something really tangible that indicates skill. Is it possible that there would be a two-year degree from a four-year institution that would be as marketable.
One thing to say right off the top is that it's actually it's a credential, and I don't know how significant the difference in those two words are, but the bill says credential.
Oh. Okay. Thank you.
Chair, Representative Reard, I think it's impossible to know with certainty. This sort of credential would have to start somewhere, and if it's brand new, one would presume it would be less valuable to employers at the outset than it might be after it develops some sort of track record. So I think we would, if we went into this endeavor, we went into it expecting to create a new credential, I think we should go in with a certain amount of caution about what it would actually mean for the student who received it, but it may nevertheless be a worthwhile undertaking.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Reardon, first I should say as a my first bachelor's degree was in philosophy, so I'm sure I wasn't prepared in the sense of, in today's sense for
it. But it prepares you so well for your testimony today before this committee, doesn't it?
Right. But I also operated as executive director as an employer and had the opportunity to read resumes and interview candidates for positions and hire. And the level of education attainment was always a question I had. And I think this, in my view, this credential, whatever it ends up being called, would be an indication of some completion or level of attainment other than on a resume, a box that's checked that says some college, which is the way a lot of applications read now. And I think, you know, there are my alma mater, the University of Wisconsin, which may be in the news in the next couple of weeks, depending on how far Oregon gets.
They were yesterday at number one seed.
I learned recently, is establishing a program of an associate's degree in the university system. However, my experience when I was a Wisconsin resident and in school was that there's a difference in the way the higher ed system is structured. Oregon has a strong community college system. Oregon or what Wisconsin system was more technical and trades two-year system. So there's differences in the states and different reasons why in that case, and I don't fully know them, why they have explored and recently announced the opportunity to get an associate's degree from the four-year institution here. And I think it's in the written testimony that I submitted. The number of associate's degrees awarded was only, I think, 63 out of some 16,000 degrees that were awarded in the most recent data in the OUS fact book. And those were very limited for specific professional credentials. I think three came from Eastern Oregon University, and the other balance of the 63 came from Oregon Institute of Technology, which is more oriented towards those kinds of technical certificates.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair. This is a really interesting conversation, and I appreciate everyone's participation in it. I'm kind of having another thought about this as we sit here, and it's around the value to the student. We have a lot of folks who start and don't complete, and when you said check the box that says some college, that struck me. And one of the things we haven't talked about is a student who invests 2 or 3 years in an education at a university level and for some reason gets sidetracked, whether life gets in the way, something occurs in that student's life that precludes them from completing. Whatever happens, we in essence disregard the value of that investment of money and time for the student when they have to check that some college box. And so that draws my attention to the fact that if we could acknowledge not only the financial investment but the investment of time, there's value in that also. And I'm not saying that very eloquently, and I'm not sure I'm getting at the point I'm trying to make. Just another aspect of how we might want to think about this for those students who, for some reason, cannot complete. That we've acknowledged that. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative McGoon. Representative Wizard.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I agree completely. I think the first priority of this bill, the goal of this bill, is people like you're describing. Yeah. The second is the 40-40-20.
Right.
That's how I prioritize what the bill does.
Anything else for these gentlemen? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. One of the things that that I'm struck by is the way that these credentials change. The history is part of my question. You all know my alma mater, Willamette, the first university west of the Mississippi. The first graduate of Willamette was a woman named Emily York. She didn't earn a bachelor's degree. A bachelor of arts. She earned a mistress of arts. I don't think that exists anymore, but it might have been more appropriate. So I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 3335 and House Bill 2561. And I'm going to open public hearings on House Bill 2860, 2870, and 2871. Victoria, these are all bills that have useful
clauses.
Relating to clauses. Is there anyone who would like to testify on any of those three bills? I don't see any. So we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2860, 2870, and 2871. I was also able to talk to Representative Witt on Friday. You remember we stood at ease for a little while to give him a chance to testify on his bill. He assured me that he did not need to testify. So we are going to skip forward on that. And it does, however, give me a chance, given its the content combined with the content of the bills from Representative Comp. Remember that this is about the testing and about transfers, to suggest I think there's an opportunity to merge those concepts into a bill. I think there's a need for a work group, and I want to invite the HEC to bring together colleges, universities, anybody else that they think is appropriate, and try to bring us back a concept or some concrete steps the campuses are committed to taking to address the issues that are in those bills. I think those are among those are the alignment of high school exams with the college placement tests, and the potential issues around credit loss when students are transferring. There are probably some others, but those are at least two issues, and maybe, or at least one question that group could address is whether the Transfer Bill of Rights needs to be strengthened or updated. I think we've got probably a couple of weeks. Is that fair, Victoria? In terms of when we're ready, so I think a 2-week deadline for that group is probably a reasonable one. And I'd be happy to have any comments from the committee. That's my impression of those bills and how they might come together. Representative Reardon?
Would the work group also look at how to take people who have not completed high school for whatever reasons and get them into the workforce?
I think clearly, I think that's an important issue. I'm not sure that it fits quite as well into the combination of these bills. I think my impression is that is a question that might be appropriately taken up in the context of the bill we just heard, 3335. I agree, it's an important one, but that seems to me to be more an issue of completion as opposed to the smooth transition through our system. Does that work for you?
I'm not sure we just communicated. So I was thinking of people that had needed a GED or something.
Okay.
That typically is their needs might be addressed by the workforce investment councils and so forth. It's a different path to getting into the workforce.
Yes.
This one I think is looking more at high school to community college, university.
Right. So okay. I'm suggesting
keep it that narrow.
I think so for the purpose of this discussion and the work group that we're trying to ask. I'd love to have a work group to come back and solve a whole bunch of issues, obviously, but trying to keep it kind of close on this one.
Chuck Williamson.
Yeah, she's back. No, we said you're back.
We're okay. I know.
That'd be fine.
Thanks for being so, Representative Williamson, I'm not sure if you left. I was just explaining, I think we're going to ask for a group to try to find the right combination of concepts around representative comps and representative Witt's bills related to transfers and testing.
That's great.
What was representative comps bill number?
I don't remember, but we'll find it for you. 2681 and 2682, says Dana.
Thank you.
The savant back there who can recall all bill numbers. Any other comments on that? Okay. I think we have exhausted our agenda. Mm-hmm. Anything else that come before the committee today?
2670? No.
2670. We carried over. Okay. Representative Buckley is back, but given his other obligations today, we expect to hear that on Wednesday.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, we're done a little bit early. We're adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.